Welcome to the third in the 2012 series of Centre for Public Policy Forums, featuring the Honourable Marilyn Warren, AC, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Victoria, and Professor Simon Evans of the Melbourne Law School, her respondent for tonight's discussion, which will be about courts and democracy. Just another agency? Question mark. My name is Steve James. I'm the Criminology Discipline Chair and the Deputy Head of the School of Social and Political Sciences here at the University of Melbourne, and I'm the Chair of tonight's session. As we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of this land, and pay respect to the elders past and present of the Kulin Nation, and extend that respect to any other Indigenous Australians present. Now, those of you on the CPP mailing list will be familiar with the work of the centre and our program of events and activities. To those of you not yet on, can I put out a special plea to join the mailing list? It's an excellent program. You get advance notice of all the upcoming events, and all it takes is an email address which you can leave with us today or register on our website. At this point, I'd like to mention, as a bit of an advertorial, that the next forum on the 21st of June will feature Terry Moran, who until recently as head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet was Australia's most senior public servant. But back to tonight's session. Chief Justice Warren was appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Victoria in November 2003. And in 1998, she was appointed to the Supreme Court of Victoria. The Chief Justice was formerly a Queen's Counsel at the Victorian Bar. She's a graduate of Monash University, which we won't hold against her. In June 2005, the Chief Justice was made a Companion of the Order of Australia. She assumed the role of Lieutenant Governor of Victoria in April 2006. As Pro-Vice-Chancellor International, Simon Evans, the respondent tonight, works in the University's International Strategy and International Relationships industry, as it were, under the Deputy Vice-Chancellor Global Engagement. Professor Simon Evans' scholarly work is as a comparative public lawyer with broad interest in constitutional and administrative law, particularly in common law and Commonwealth countries. He holds an ARC-funded discovery project to analyse the powers and accountabilities of the executive branch of government. He recently completed a major project investigating the capacity of parliaments to protect human rights and the effectiveness of the Commonwealth model of human rights protection. The format for tonight is as follows. The Chief Justice will speak first for about 40 minutes or so. Professor Evans will then offer up a response for about 10 or 15 minutes. We'll then open up the floor for questions from the audience, the Q&A session, and discussion. The presentations will be recorded, but not the Q&A session. There'll be a post-event reception in the auditorium, so please stay around and relax in a convivial fashion and capture the excitement of the night. So it's my great pleasure to introduce the Honourable Marilyn Warren. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Professor James, for that very warm welcome. And thank you, everyone, for coming out this evening to listen to what I believe to be a very important and indeed fundamental discussion in our society. It goes to the very heart of our democracy. It is something about which everyone should be interested, those in the political sphere, members of the judiciary, members of the public sector, and those in the community working in the private sector. Because at the end of the day, it all comes back to our democratic structure. I'd like to start this evening by talking about what I perceive to be a public misapprehension of the role of the courts. Recently, the Australian newspaper published an article about some problems in the Victorian Department of Justice and the corrections system. The article related to the death of a prisoner in custody. It included a statement that I thought told a story. The statement was that there were failings at the highest levels of justice. Now, the report was about the Department of Justice and Corrections Victoria, which falls under that department. The article in no way was concerned about the courts. And yet, there were failings at the highest levels of justice. This statement troubled me. It involved a misapprehension of justice and the role of the courts. It is a misapprehension perpetuated these days within the public sector and possibly misunderstood and perpetuated in the media and inevitably in the community. But justice is delivered by the courts applying the rule of law. This evening, rather than my delivering a formal and some might say a pontificating address about the rule of law, let me try to give the concept a political setting, given this forum. 10 years ago, the Commonwealth heads of government met in Abuja in Nigeria, and they adopted a recommendation to receive and accept, implement the Latimer House principles on the three branches of government. These were seen as a set of guidelines on good practice governing relations between the executive, the parliament, and the judiciary in the promotion of good governance, the rule of law, and human rights. Although now 10 years on, the principles are worth revisiting. They describe the three branches of government, or the Trinity, articulated by Montesquieu centuries ago. They describe the relations between Parliament and the judiciary, and they state that the relations should be governed by respect for Parliament's primary responsibility for lawmaking on the one hand, and for the judiciary's responsibility for the interpretation and the application of the rule of law on the other. Significantly, the guidelines state that the judiciaries and Parliaments should fulfil their respective but critical roles in the promotion of the rule of law in, and these words are important, a complementary and constructive manner. The guidelines go on to discuss the independence of the judiciary. They state that an independent, impartial, honest, and competent judiciary is integral to upholding the rule of law, engendering public confidence, and dispensing justice. The guidelines include a section on the role of non-judicial and non-parliamentary institutions, and in that section, they expressly focus on the role of the executive. Significantly, the guidelines state that an independent, organised legal profession is an essential component in the protection of the rule of law, and that the executive must refrain from obstructing the functioning of an independent legal profession. So, against that background of the Latimer House guidelines, I would like to turn to what I perceive is the incongruity of the public sector and political perception of the courts as part of the government of the day. Now, the Latimer House guidelines state the high principles that would be adopted, I am sure, without hesitation by Victorian politicians and public administrators. Let us look, however, as to how the interaction between the Parliament, the judiciary, and the executive plays out in practice. It is particularly the interaction between the judiciary and the executive upon which I will focus. If we cast back a little in time, we will recall that Thatcherism had a dramatic impact on public administration. Under the leadership of former Victorian Premier Jeff Kennett, Victoria shifted to mega departments, and the courts found themselves as mere business units alongside areas such as gaming, emergency services, corrections, and police. The title of Justice was appropriated to cover all sorts of non-court functions, indeed anything remotely connected to social control, culminating in what we know as a Department of Justice. Under this system, departmental officers make the ultimate decisions, not the courts, about the provision of resources to the courts. Thus, notwithstanding its constitutional function under the Australian Constitution and the Constitution Act of Victoria, the Supreme Court of Victoria is Business Unit 19 of the Department of Justice. For a long time now, law and order has become part of the political armoury of the modern politician. We see the development of law and order as a political topic overlooking or pushing to one side the traditional role of the rule of law. I can remember years ago Senator Ivor Greenwood speaking publicly at rallies, and there was great outcry against him. He spoke about the need for law and order and the promotion of a sense of safety in the community. Decades on, this, of course, has continued to be developed into a main political plank of modern state governments. Law and order is associated with a prominent police presence and a strong spectre of corrections as a consequence of any breach to the laws of the state. Yet whilst the police investigate and prevent crime, and the corrections authorities carry out society's admonition, punishment, rehabilitation, and the general consequences for criminal offending, it is only achievable because of the application of the rule of law by the courts. Parliament creates the laws of society, and together with the common law and judge-made law developed by the courts, we have the set of rules that underpin the rule of law. However, as we know, Parliament is the lawmaker. It is up to the courts to apply the rule of law. So, for example, it is not the role of the Parliament to submit a person to trial for wrongdoing and, if convicted, sentence the individual. That is the role of the courts. I suspect it is, in fact, confusing for the public, which starts out equating courts with justice, to observe blurred lines between the facilitator of resources for the courts, the government department, the investigator of crime, the police, and the enforcer of the court's decision, the corrections system. We would rarely hear a politician or public administrator speak of the rule of law. Rather, they are more likely to speak of law and order and community safety. What, in fact, has occurred is that the concept of the rule of law has merged with the more populist catch cry, law and order and community safety. I want to look now at public administrators and their concept of justice as a service that they, the public administrators, provide compared with the application of the rule of law by the courts. It is important to understand that the courts serve the community. However, the courts do not serve the community in the same way as do members of Parliament or public administrators. Courts serve the community by applying the rule of law in an honest, non-corrupt, and transparent way. The courts cannot apply the rule of law in a way that is politically expedient or subject to the policies of the government of the day. This of itself sometimes creates a misapprehension on the part of public administrators as to what they believe the courts should do. This is especially so with public administrators, I suspect, who do not come from a legal background. Alexander Hamilton cautioned in the Federalist Papers that in practice the judiciary is the weakest of the three branches of government because it controls neither the sword or the purse. Yet, through the application of the rule of law, the courts have the power and authority to overrule or strike down the laws made by the Parliament, to direct or restrain actions by ministers of the Crown, and the public administrators serving that very government. One way of comprehending the value and significance of courts to our democratic structure is to reflect on the types of cases that go through the courts. In this regard, I focus upon the significance of the role that the courts play in cases where the citizen versus the state and the citizen versus the citizen. In criminal cases, inevitably, the state, represented by the prosecuting authority, brings a citizen before the court. So, if an individual has killed another individual, the prosecuting authority in this state will have charges laid against that person, prosecute the person through the courts. It is a matter of the citizen versus the state. And there we have our important fundamental principles that are applied in our criminal justice system. A person is entitled to a fair trial, a fair hearing, and is innocent until proved guilty beyond reasonable doubt. Whilst we now have the Charter of Human Rights in Victoria, these principles are ancient rights that can be traced back to the origins of our society, the development of the rule of law, and our civilization as we know it. If we think about it, day in, day out in the Victorian courts, individuals are prosecuted for minor through to major criminal offending. On any given day, all across the state, but in particular in Melbourne, individuals are prosecuted for offences in the Magistrates' Court, such as drink driving, assault, theft, drug trafficking, and possession. In the County Court, individuals are prosecuted for more serious crime and are tried before a jury of 12 individuals, 12 peers. The prosecution carries the obligation to prove the guilt beyond reasonable doubt of the individual. In the County Court, the serious offences played out each day involve cases such as intentionally causing serious injury, drug trafficking, and theft. In the Supreme Court, mostly the cases are homicide cases where the citizen faces the prospect of life imprisonment if convicted. And so you see with that panorama which is occurring in our courts every day of the week, the state brings the citizen before the courts, and it is the courts that dispense justice to the citizen. It is not a government department. It is not a parliament that dispenses that justice. There is another way, if we reflect on it, in which the courts are important and significant in our democratic society. The courts are important in maintaining peace and harmony in our society. Sometimes it is forgotten in the running commentaries about our political structures that the courts play that critical, fundamental role. Professor Hazel Jen, in the 2008 Hamlin Lectures, spoke about the role of civil justice as a public good. It facilitates peaceful dispute resolution between citizens, thereby avoiding citizens resorting to confrontation and violence, as may occur in less civilized societies. There is a collective benefit in the rule of law playing out in action in that it supports the tranquility of the state through ensuring social order, cohesion, and significantly, restraint on the executive. Professor Jen also points out that civil justice reinforces the civic values and norms of our society. Most disputes in society are not resolved in a court. In the civil cases litigated in the courts, less than about 5% ultimately go before a judge. These days, civil litigation is largely resolved through alternative dispute resolution, such as mediation and arbitration or settlement between the parties. However, it is a fact of a civil justice system symbolised by the courts that enables parties to enforce their rights. It is the very fact of the existence and the right to go before a court that leads to dispute resolution. It is also the power and authority of the courts that will bring reluctant parties to the negotiating table. Sometimes there is a view in society that judges are old-fashioned because of the ancient rituals of the courtroom, our procedures, our insistence on process, and very often our appearance in the robes that we wear. However, the modern judiciary plays a critical role in the efficient management of cases and the promotion of alternative dispute resolution between parties, frequently culminating in settlement of cases to the greater social good. Peace and harmony breaks out in the society because the dispute between citizen and citizen is resolved. Now, that is the civil side. On the criminal side, there has been a growth in the criminal justice system. We need only look at lawyers' shelves to see the numbers of statutes enacted in state and federal parliaments each year to have some indication of the extent to which modern society is controlled by the laws of the state. Professor Jen has described this phenomenon as legislative hyperactivity. Inevitably, as politicians and public administrators seek to ensure the delivery of the law and order agenda combined with a sense of safety in the community, so there is a greater call on the judiciary to oversee the application of those laws, the application of the rule of law, and of course, importantly, the protection of the citizens' rights. But just as the courts are the protectors of the rule of law, so they need to be protected and separated from the government. In the interests of society, the courts, as the protectors of the rule of law, need themselves to be protected and separated from the executive. Sometimes, too, they need to be protected from the parliament. However, there is a dramatic difference between the performance of the courts in their role and function and that of the executive. Let me talk about that for a moment. The judiciary performs in a constant way. It is transparent, it is open to the public, and it performs in a way that the public knows how the outcome was determined. If any of you in this audience this evening was so minded tomorrow, you could go down to the intersection of William Street and Lonsdale Street, in a sense the Victorian axis of justice. You could walk into a courtroom in any of the Supreme Court, the County Court, the Magistrates Court. You could watch a civil trial, a criminal trial. You could watch a civil appeal, a criminal appeal. You could walk down King Street. You could go into a hearing of the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. You could come back and go in just off Lonsdale Street into some of the sittings of the Children's Court. You would be able to go into hearings in the Coroner's Court up in Exhibition Street. You have that capacity because justice is open in this state. The courts perform openly and transparently every day. They do that so that the public knows what is happening, what goes on in the courts. Each day, the court lists contain the cases so the public will know what cases are being heard. The courts facilitate the media learning which cases will be determined on a particular day. The media come in, they report on the cases. This reporting also enables the public, if they wish, to know more about what is going on in the courts and perhaps come and listen. There is a big difference between what the public sees when they come into the courts and what they might see if they were able to go in, what happens in the executive arm of government. When the public come, they do not see in the courtroom a bureaucrat performing an office-like function, writing a report, preparing a budget, or distributing funding across a department. A judge does not sit at a desk in a private office. Instead, a judge sits in an open courtroom. The events in the courtroom, that is what is being said by the barristers, what is being said by the witnesses, what is said by the judge, are recorded. The evidence is documented and recorded. The case is argued in open court before an impartial, unbiased individual who is beyond corruption. The judge is independent and must be so. Ultimately, when the case is decided, a judge is bound to give reasons for the decision. This is part of the transparency also. The judge is not preparing a report to a political master. The judge provides a reasoned judgment which is publicly available to the parties and in the Supreme Court, usually online, so that the public knows why the decision was reached. This in turn enables an aggrieved individual to have at least one right of appeal to a higher court to identify any error by the first court. All this is part of the justice system. It is a long way from the offices of the Department of Justice. However, judges need to be able to focus on their work as a judge in an environment which is adequately resourced. It is difficult for the courts to compete against the palpable human demands of medical care, educational needs, and housing and accommodation requirements. It is easy to comprehend why a politician will more readily react to meeting the fundamental human needs of health, education, and housing before turning to the sometimes less obvious needs of justice. However, if we do not have courts applying the rule of law and delivering justice, we put at risk the very provision of health, education, and housing services within a democracy, because without the courts, there will be no democracy. It is fundamental to our democratic society that the courts be protected and separated from the executive. I want to turn now to the present situation here in Victoria, the provision of resources and services by the Department of Justice and the rest of the public sector to the Victorian courts. Ultimately, it is my view that it is undesirable for a government department, here the Department of Justice, to be doing things such as controlling judges' staff, controlling court registries, controlling IT, and other essential elements of a modern day court. In Victoria, we have a courts governance system where court budgets and resources are controlled by the Department of Treasury and Finance and the Department of Justice. Treasury determines each year the budget to be provided to the courts. For the Supreme Court, we have an annual budget of about $50 million. A large vote of the total budget of the Department of Justice is calculated on the provision of the needs of the courts. The courts make some contribution to the revenue that accumulates to the government. The Supreme Court of Victoria is the largest revenue earner of the courts for the state government. Approximately 31% of the cost of the Supreme Court is recovered by the fees that are charged to parties to litigate in the court. Compared with the Federal Court of Australia, the fee recovery is in the order of 9 to 11%. It is not a well-known fact in the community that the fees that we charge the parties to litigate in the court, and this is essentially in the civil sector, are not kept by the court. Those fees go into consolidated revenue. A little money, and I emphasise a little money, comes back to the courts under what is called a Section 29 agreement under the Financial Management Act. What happens there is that a proportion of funding, which is identified and determined by the Department of Treasury and Finance under the Section 29 agreement, is made available to the Attorney General of the day. The Attorney General will then decide how those funds are to be divided up between the courts. In the last 10 years or thereabouts, the funds have not necessarily gone directly to the courts. In many instances, the funds have gone to fund ongoing recurring expenses for facilities provided within the Department of Justice as distinct from directly to the courts. It is curious that, for example, with the commercial court within the Supreme Court of Victoria, we charge a premium for parties to litigate in that particular component of the court, and we charge that premium in order to ostensibly fund the cost of an additional service that is provided to litigators. The fact is that whilst the litigators pay that premium, no additional service is provided to the litigating parties over and above what would occur elsewhere. What the parties receive is the judicial acumen, energy and application and general zeal and dynamism of the individual judges who make the contribution at their own cost, sit on more cases, sit longer hours, work on weekends so that commercial cases are determined expeditiously in this state. Meanwhile, the government is able, through consolidated revenue, to pocket the premium which the court charges. The Victorian Department of Justice has a very large budget. Included in its budget is a component for depreciation and contingency. If the courts need funding for their buildings or to meet an unexpected contingency, and this occurred, for example, to the Supreme Court building with the hailstorm that occurred a couple of years ago here in Melbourne, where the courts suffered severe damage, the courts must appeal to the Department of Justice to accommodate the financial need. If an unexpected phenomenon occurs in litigation, such as the prosecution of the various killings during the gangland era, we must turn to the Department of Justice to provide us with the necessary funding to meet that demand. We have no independent resources available to us. If government introduces law reform measures such as extended supervision orders for serious sex offenders whose sentences have expired, the courts are expected to simply take on the extra burden. Similarly, when governments determine to increase the resources of the police, traditionally, this has occurred in isolation without considering what the consequences might be for the courts. Let me give you a recent example. The state government, over a period of years, will increase the police numbers in Victoria by 1,700. We know that the Victoria Police will use the increased numbers to particularly focus on domestic violence and sexual offending. Experience dictates, and this is my perspective, that inevitably there will be increased reporting of crime and therefore an increased prosecution of crime within the courts. However, no provision is made for an increase in the judiciary and courts' resources to meet the demand that will flow on from the increased police numbers. I would estimate that the increased number of police in Victoria will lead to an increase in the order or range of about 25% of sexual offences cases in this state. This in turn will have a flow-on effect into trial courts, in particular the county court, and then the appeal court within the Supreme Court. That is not to suggest in any way that I am critical of the increase in police numbers. Rather, it is to demonstrate that if the courts are to perform their role and function of applying the rule of law, then they should not be involved in the political equation. It needs to be understood that the courts are above and beyond politics. More recently, the state government announced its sustainability measures, resulting in reduction in numbers of staff in the public sector. In the last 8 years, the courts have largely been quarantined from these arrangements. The cut in staff numbers was announced across the board with very few exemptions. Initially, the courts were not excluded, and thus the reductions would have applied to judges' staff. Fortunately, the Attorney General of Victoria intervened, and that situation was largely remedied. But let me explain that what occurred with the sustainability measures demonstrated that those working in Treasury will make decisions based on Treasury criteria and not understand the ramifications to justice by the impact on the courts of the Treasury decision. When a judge sits in a court, their staff are essential to the judicial process. If I take a criminal trial, the judge's staff consist of an associate and tip staff or two associates. With a criminal trial, those staff assist with the empanelment and management of the jury. The judge does not do that directly. I mentioned earlier that everything that occurs in courts is recorded. In trials, transcripts are produced. The staff who prepare the transcripts, the Victorian Government Reporting Service, prepare the spoken word of what the judge, barristers and witnesses say in court. But the courts do not themselves directly control and fund the provision of that transcript. Court cases do not occur in isolation. Parties need to file papers in both criminal and civil proceedings, trial and appellate. These papers are received in registries where files are created, both hard and soft copy. Judges do not create the files, but the files themselves are an important part of the judicial process. The file will contain the very document called the writ that commences the proceeding and brings the dispute before the court. All these files and documents need to be managed. Court registries are an integral part of courts and their function. However, when the sustainability announcements were made by the government, decisions were made as to staff that directly impacted upon what happens in the courtroom and the judge's application of the rule of law. Judges' staff, initially, were to be subject to the measures, as were court reporting services and as were court registries. Exemptions were very quickly obtained. As a demonstration of the executive controlling the courts, in the Victorian Parliamentary Public Accounts and Estimates Committee Outcomes reports for 2010-11, a very curious paragraph appeared. It recited that the results for the Department of Justice's performance measure, quality of court registry services, had consistently been above 95%, but that for the particular year the figure had declined to 85%. The Public Accounts and Estimates Committee approached the Department of Justice for information about what was described as the sudden and significant decline in service quality. The department responded saying that the 85% figure was merely an estimate and that the actual result was confirmed at 95%. The department went on to report that it, the department, has produced changes to ensure the actual result can be reported sooner rather than rely on an estimate. Now, the question must be asked, what was the Department of Justice doing reporting about the performance and work of a court registries? To be direct, it is none of the business of the Department of Justice. More so, it was curious that the department did not involve the courts themselves, certainly not the Supreme Court, in seeking advice on performance of the court's registry. Another point, the PAYAC committee found the information that it led to its making the inquiry of the Department of Justice in the annual report of the department. A further question can be asked. What was the Department of Justice doing reporting on court registry services in its annual departmental report? Again, I reiterate, the performance of court registries is nothing to do with the Department of Justice. It is the business of the courts themselves. For many years, the courts have been concerned about the fact that IT services are encompassed within the mega department of the Department of Justice. The concern was heightened with the announcement of the previous government of the Senatex proposal for the centralisation of IT resources. In a nutshell, the Supreme Court informed the government, the then government, that it would not participate in the Senatex process. It was seen to go to the very heart of the independence of the judiciary. As matters stand, there is potential capacity for the operation of the for the operators of the Department of Justice IT system to look into the judgments of judges before they are delivered. That is not to say it occurs. Nonetheless, the potential is dangerous and offensive. However, I am very pleased to say that in all likelihood, before the end of the current financial year, the Department of Justice will facilitate the courts in, or the Supreme Court, in achieving a separate IT system from the Department of Justice. For the first time, judges' emails, judgments, and other court documents will be entirely separate from the Department of Justice. Now, it might be asked, is the Supreme Court being a little too precious about this, a little too sensitive? The fact remains that a significant litigator, particularly in relation to individual citizens' rights in the Supreme Court, is the Secretary of the Department of Justice and the Department itself. The need for the independence of the Supreme Court in this regard is self-evident. Inevitably, there are other aspects of government management of courts that cause disquiet. We need only think of the integrated courts management system, which was the subject of criticism by the Ombudsman in his report on government IT services. This system was developed over 6 years ago by the then Victorian government in order to achieve an integrated data collection system for the courts. It has been implemented so far only in the Supreme Court and partly in the Coroner's Court, but at a total cost of over $60 million. It has not proved a success. In developing the system, the Department of Justice held the control and took the leadership function in relation to this system. The judiciary was essentially left out of the development and specification process. The report of the Ombudsman demonstrates the need for the courts to have their own system and to self-manage that system. I will now move on to speak briefly about the different systems of governance in Australia. We essentially have three models. There is the independent self-managed model, of which the Federal Court of Australia is the obvious example. There is the Courts Authority model in South Australia, which again is a separate and independent model. Then we have what is known as the executive model. Through the discussion this evening, I have given examples of what happens here in Victoria. Most states have an executive model, and Victoria is the most extreme example of the executive model. That then leads me on to speak briefly about where we are up to here in Victoria with courts governance. A number of attempts have been made for almost 10 years to change the system and to overcome some of the difficulties I have described, as well as deal with the significant matters of principle. 18 months ago, the Victorian Attorney General Robert Clark commenced the development of a new courts governance model for Victoria. The Attorney General largely contemplated a South Australian courts authority model with appropriate adaptation for Victoria, including any suitable aspects of the federal system. Study discussions were led by the Attorney with the Victorian Heads of Jurisdiction and the Chief Justice of South Australia and others. We also met with the Federal Chief Justice of the Federal Court and the Family Court. Next, the Victorian Attorney established an advisory group chaired by the former Federal Court Chief Justice, the Honourable Michael Black. It consisted of Victorian heads of jurisdiction, the secretaries of the departments of Premiers, Treasury and Justice, and two leading independent economists. We met for the better part of 2011 and provided a report to the Attorney General. The Attorney General's proposal to separate the courts from the executive arm of government is largely supported by the courts. It is a very principled stand, which I very much welcome. However, inevitably, the creation of a court's executive service and separating it from the executive arm of government is challenging for public administrators. In my experience, the courts are challenged by the public administrators as to why and how they should be separated from the executive arm, with a largely dominant focus on cost saving, economies of scale, efficiencies, and productivity savings. If I might turn back to some of my observations at the beginning of this discourse, this kind of language and approach seems to equate courts with government departments, hence the title and question of this discussion. A little while ago in this state, the community services component of the Victorian Department of Health was separated. A new department was created. The split cost millions of dollars. By contrast, The separation of the courts from the Victorian Department of Justice is considered by current public administrators to be one that can be achieved on a cost-neutral basis, which will provide efficiencies and opportunities for cost savings. Do remember here, we are talking about the separation of the third arm of government, not the splitting off of a department. Whereas the health experience was allocated millions, the courts are expected to achieve something greater and something that, in terms of our social democratic society, is of incomparable significance, but we are expected to do it with savings. It seems to me that there is a misunderstanding, indeed misapprehension, as to the role of the courts. The Victorian Attorney continues to pursue the establishment of the Court's Executive Service. As I say, he is supported by the courts. At this point, I've spoken at length about what the courts do in terms of their role and function. I have given you some examples about the interaction between the courts and the Department of Justice and the provision of services. I should speak this evening about courts' accountability and performance and the measurement of courts' performance. All of the Victorian courts are accountable to the Victorian Parliament. We each provide separate annual reports to the Parliament. In addition, under the Council of Australian Governments regime, there is an annual report of government services. Included in the report is a chapter on courts' administration. In the chapter, there is detailed analysis of each of the state and federal courts on a state and national basis, broken down into categories of civil and criminal, trial and appellate. The report is intended to provide a national comparison of courts' performance. In addition, in the Supreme Court, as part of assessing our own performance, we have embarked upon the International Framework for Court Excellence. The framework was developed by an international consortium. Under the rubric of the consortium, the Supreme Court has developed a strategic statement. Our goal is to be an outstanding superior court. We define our purpose as safeguarding and maintaining the rule of law to ensure equal access to justice, fairness, impartiality, and independence in decision making, processes that are transparent, timely, and certain, accountability for the court's use of public resources, and the highest standards of competence and personal integrity. In addition, as part of the framework, we have developed a five-year plan, a business plan, and prepared to publish public feedback and assessment of our performance on the court's website. All of this is intended to be part of the ongoing improvement of transparency and accountability of the Supreme Court. The framework documents I just mentioned will, I hope soon, go up on the Supreme Court website. Ironically, they are presently delayed because we, the Supreme Court, must await the approval and facilitation by the government's e-gov services before we can put up on our own website our own material. I would like to turn briefly, for the sake of completion this evening, to the topic of external review of courts' performance. There are other agencies that, from time to time, will purport to vet courts' performance. The Auditor General, the Ombudsman, and if established, IBAC. The question of performance audits of non-judicial functions of courts was examined in Victoria by a parliamentary committee reviewing the Audit Act. Ultimately, the committee concluded that the Auditor General would be able, under appropriate circumstances, to audit non-judicial functions. However, and the legal advice to the committee independently was to this effect, there are difficulties in discerning the line between what is judicial and what is non-judicial or administrative. A similar principle applies with respect to the Ombudsman. As for IBAC, or any corruption commission that may be established, at the end of the day, someone must supervise the investigator. Someone must protect the citizen and enforce the citizen's rights against the state. At the end of the day, that will be the courts. I turn now to the need for recognition of courts' capacity to be accountable and administratively competent. The reticence or scepticism that is displayed by some when considering greater independence for courts fails to recognise the effectiveness of the modern superior court. The Victorian Supreme Court, for a number of years now, has achieved a balanced budget. We are accountable for what we receive and how we spend it. The court has dramatically reduced delays through judge-driven initiatives and reforms. The court has introduced its own electronic filing system, presently being piloted, called Redcrest, at a fraction of the cost of the ICMS system I mentioned earlier. There are all sorts of things that we are doing within the court. When we look at the COAG-ROGS data I mentioned earlier, we see that the Victorian Supreme Court delivers civil justice at a comparatively efficient and economic level. So then, let me postulate the question. What is every citizen entitled to expect from the courts? Every Victorian citizen is entitled to expect a judiciary made up of judges who are independent and impartial and who decide cases without fear, favour, affection or ill will. That is the judicial oath that we take as judges. The citizen is also entitled to be confident that there will be sufficient judges assigned to hear cases, that court sittings will be scheduled, that court lists will be controlled and managed in a way that cases can be heard expeditiously, that there will be courtrooms available where judges can sit and determine cases, and that there will be a registry and court staff capable of carrying out these functions and supporting the judges in the delivery of justice in the determination of disputes between citizens and the citizen and the state. Above all else, the citizen is entitled to expect a judiciary which is independent of the government of the day, independent of the parliament and the executive, and beyond corruption. I would like to invite discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. I call upon the respondent, Professor Simon Evans.
Thank you, Professor James. Thank you, Chief Justice, for a remarkably stimulating address that engages some of the great questions of our constitutional system, great and old questions that go back many centuries. The great debates of the Jacobite era, the conflict between executive and the judges as to the authority of the executive to make and change the laws that define part of the constitutional history of our tradition from the 17th century. And set against those establishment of important principles around the independence of the judiciary, the later development of clear principles of responsible government, the idea that the parliament controls the appropriation of revenues that support the actions of the executive government, and in fact, eventually, all the facets of the state. I want to develop those themes of independence of the judiciary and responsible government in the course of these brief remarks. But I want to start by underscoring what I took to be the fundamental theme of the Chief Justice's remarks, and that is the absolute centrality of independence of the judiciary in suits between citizen or in any individual, really, and the state. The critical importance of that to our constitutional tradition. I was reminded this morning by the presenter on AM that the Liberal Party, currently in opposition in federal level, has not been as popular as it is now, measured by opinion polls, since September 2001, since the time of the Tampa and the time of the attacks on the Twin Towers. We remember the Tampa now, the Norwegian vessel that rescued some 400 plus asylum seekers, and then was turned away from Christmas Island by the executive government of the Commonwealth. Remember it as a landmark political event leading to the re-election of the Howard government in 2001. We constitutional scholars remember it as a very significant decision on the powers of the executive government. Ultimately, the decision favoured the executive government. But imagine what it would say about our system of government, our nation, if that decision had been reached in any way other than by the application of the law administered by independent and impartial judicial system. The decision in the Tampa case affected the fundamental rights of more than 400 individual asylum seekers, and it's but one of many hundreds of decisions over the past decade in which individuals have sought to assert their rights against government, have sought to challenge government decisions, have sought to challenge government laws. I think of cases like Roach, in which Commonwealth electoral laws that disenfranchised prisoners were challenged and struck down by the High Court, a decision resisted by the government in the court, but acceded in as the outcome of a decision of an independent court. Myriad migration and administrative law cases, as well as all the criminal cases that the Chief Justice referred to, in which the state moves against the individual. These decisions of independent courts then shape the administration of the law by the public service. And in all of this, we depend on the fundamental independence of the judges from questions of public opinion. The decision in the Tampa may have gone in favour of the government, but I don't think anyone suggests it was influenced by public opinion. The decision of the High Court in Roach probably went against public opinion. I don't know if anyone's tested that. But again, we live in a system that benefits from the immateriality of that question to the independent decision-making of the courts. And that's what must be defended at all costs, the decisional independence of the judges, the ability of the judges to administer the law, as the Chief Justice said, without fear or favour, without affection or ill will, in accordance with the law. What then is the role of the Parliament and the executive government? What are the proper limits that can be put around that independence? Clearly, executive government and the legislature cannot purport to direct the outcome of individual cases. They cannot purport to interfere in the administration of justice in the individual case. But again, since the constitutional revolution of the 17th century, it is the Parliament that controls the revenues, controls the public fisc, that supports the operations of all of the state. I don't say all of the government, I want to distinguish between the government and the courts here. Although the courts raise a significant proportion of their operating budget from the fees that the Chief Justice referred to, and inappropriately, as the Chief Justice pointed out, had denied recourse directly to those fees, I don't think very many people would say that the courts should be responsible for raising the totality of their budgets from fees, from user pays approach. The system of justice is a fundamental responsibility of the state and should be provided, one would think, as a public good accessible by all. But that then throws us back to the question of who controls, who decides how much revenue the courts get to discharge their functions. And it's a profoundly challenging question, because as the Chief Justice has pointed out, the people are entitled to enough judges, enough courtrooms that have repairs done to them after they're struck by hail. Perhaps the issue can be tested by an extreme case. Several of the countries of Europe, not least Greece at the moment, are experiencing a fundamental economic shock, a collapse in the revenues of the state and the ability to provide the services that had been provided to date. And that will impact on all manner of services provided to the people of the country. Should, and here I'm being deliberately provocative and making all sorts of assumptions, false assumptions about the structure of the Greek judicial system and so on, but should the courts be exempt in toto from belt tightening in situations of extreme financial distress? Or is there some scope for the people represented in Parliament to say, not only are we willing to accept reductions and delays in the health service available in our public hospitals, we are also willing to accept reductions and delays in the service available in our courts? Deliberately provocative in two ways. One, it picks up the sense of service the Chief Justice, I think, rightly objected to in her remarks. And secondly, provocative because it's an extreme situation. I wonder if the thing that must be kept firmly in mind, and this is, again, what I took from the Chief Justice's remarks, the thing to be kept firmly in mind is the importance of the decisional independence of the judges. That what ultimately matters beyond all of concerns about service is the ability of the judges to decide independently of the will of the government in individual cases. And I want to say something about terminology, just about the word justice. It's such a powerful and evocative word that runs through the writing on the separation of powers. It runs through the writing on the constitutional system generally, on the evolution of from a pre-modern British constitution into a modern Australian constitution, through all the permutations and changes along the way. Justice is one of the ends that is served by fundamental constitutional principles, the rule of law, the separation of powers. But it's also something that is served by agents and actors outside the court system. And I think this is something that the Chief Justice might resist a little. I understood her remarks to attempt to reclaim the idea of justice as one that something that the courts dispense and that administrators don't. I think that courts certainly do dispense justice, but it may be a lost battle to seek to exclude the administration, the executive branch of government, from its claims to have a role in securing a just society. We ask that administrators make decisions that are fair, reasonable and just. We hold them up to scrutiny in tribunals and for the Ombudsman if the decisions they make are not, do not satisfy those terms. Moreover, we hold them up to scrutiny, searching scrutiny against those terms in the media. And one of the reasons I think that it's important to allow the word justice to be a measure for the actions of the executive and legislative branches of government is that justice is too big a challenge for the courts. The reason is this. As the Chief Justice emphasised, the courts administer the rule of law. They administer the law. And the law is not always just. The law is a particular concretization, a particular realization of a principle of justice that will inevitably leave some people out. It'll be over-inclusive, under-inclusive. It'll be fair to some and unfair to others. It'll be just in some circumstances and unjust in others. And the judge's job, the court's job, is to enforce the law first. And if it happens that that delivers justice, so be it. But where the court, where the outcome is unjust, the outcome dictated by the law, interpreted in light of the fundamental commitments of the law to human rights and so on, when the judges interpret to the greatest extent that they possibly can to realise justice but can't, there they still must stop and accept that not every outcome of the courts will be just. So I think that's one reason to preserve space for language of a responsibility of government broadly conceived to act and deliver justly. But the one fundamental in which we cannot compromise, emphasised throughout tonight, is the independence of the judges in deciding how far they can go, what the outcome must be, and when, as often as must be the case, the government must lose and not enforce its will against the paramount rights of the citizen. Thanks.